philosophers in
space.
Once again, this is Rumor Control. Here are the facts.
I was thinking of the immortal words of Socrates, who said, I drank what?
Mythology is one of the primary motivations for cultural development.
Maybe it is. What's that got to do with filming a play?
Exactly!
What does that mean?
I don't know!
We will solve our own problems as you commanded. The time has come to convert the unbelievers.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 103. I'm Thomas. That's Aaron. How you doing, Aaron?
I'm great. My trap has sprung. I baited a beautiful trap to catch someone incredibly brilliant, and now we've suckered them in, and we're going to torture them for information.
Here, I'll put on some wispy clothing.
Okay.
Some creepy, get my creepy hands going.
Sounds good. I will turn away from the screen so no one can ever see my face.
Yeah, that's the key.
Would you like to introduce our ringer?
Would you like to introduce our... We're joined by Mike Hall, who apparently likes this show, Doctor Who. We're going to talk a lot about that. How's it going, Mike?
Very good, thank you. I don't know how I feel about being on the show, as it was a piece of blatant manipulation on your part in order to get me on the show, and I don't know if I'm more annoyed at the manipulation or that it worked. That's a really frustrating situation for me to be in.
We should tell everyone we watched Cube 4 Groundhog's Cube. Which is a Doctor Who... Oh, sorry. Cubes 4, Groundhog's Cubes, CSI Miami ending is what we watched. That's exactly the
fairly
show.
Fairly accurate.
It'll make sense if you watch it.
And I do appreciate the meta that, like the Doctor, we have trapped Mike exactly for this purpose of just repeated...
Just think how many times he's had to do this show.
Right.
This is like the 4,000th recording. We're still bad at it. It's going to take us eons, everybody.
I think he would prefer the veil.
Do we make Brian edit every single version? Like, is Brian in his own personal hell, too?
Well, sure, yeah. We're all in our own personal hells here. I think that's pretty much the moral of current events.
What did we actually watch? We watched season 9, episode 11 of Doctor Who called Heaven Sent. That's what we watched.
Mm-hmm. Which happened.
And I love that Aaron gave me critical info. As somebody who doesn't watch Doctor Who, I've seen like what now, one episode, two episodes that we've done. You gave me the critical info. Oh, hey, Thomas, I know you've never seen any of this. Here's what you need to know going into this. Doctor Who's friend died or something. And like, that was all you told me? It's like, well, that helped. That's all clear now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what
I mean. It was legitimately all you needed to know is that the Doctor opens the start of this episode and he is trying to find the people who've just killed his best friend, and that's really all you need to know going into the top of this episode.
Okay, no, it's a good mystery. I don't understand any. I understand this episode anyway. We should break it down. Let's tell Brian to punch it. Anybody want to do the guest honors, or should I do it?
Mike, you want to give us a British punch it?
Brian, punch it!
Personally, I think that's a hell of a bird.
All right, Brian has punched it. Well, we have a guest, so that would probably be better than me trying to explain Doctor Who. So, Mike, you want to tell us what happened?
So, Doctor Who is... the best TV show ever made. And I will hear no dissent on that on that position. So this is an episode of Doctor Who called Heaven Sent, which was written by Stephen Moffat, who was he was the lead writer on the show at the time. He also wrote the previous episode that you guys watched, The Girl in the Fireplace. He also wrote that episode as well.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And... He's was also the executive producer and creator of Sherlock as well, the Benedict Cumberbatch modern day Sherlock Holmes show as well. And Stephen Moffat's got a reputation for some quite clever writing that kind of lays out a mystery, and then right at the end he, you know, snaps his fingers and it suddenly makes sense. And you may well recognize that pattern from Girl in the Fireplace as well, where right at the end it's, oh, and by the way, these are repair droids that are out of control, and that's why all of this weird stuff happened, and there was a horse on a spaceship and a Madame de Pompadour and so on. So Stephen likes to write around corners like this, and it's one of the reasons why he's very popular as a writer and continues to win awards for it. In this episode, we're presented with the Doctor appears at the start of the episode in a teleport, where he is faced with what is apparently a haunted castle with a veiled figure that is chasing him around in a torture chamber that appears to have been designed exclusively to torture him. The creature that's following around this torture chamber is a he describes it as a figure literally out of his own nightmares of an old woman who died when he was a kid, and they covered her in veils, but it was a very hot day, and so she started to decay very very, very quickly, and that's the figure was pulled out of his nightmares and made to chase him around. And as the Doctor is pursued around this this mage, this trap, this torture chamber, he has to try and figure out why he's there, and who put him there, what they put him there for, and how he can escape. At the same time, he's trying to find out who just killed his best friend, which happened in the previous episode, which is a mystery that is not resolved. It's actually resolved in the following episode.
He also needs to find his sunglasses. He does. That's a pretty important part of the episode.
His sonic sunglasses. That's good. That was it. That was an in joke.
He whips them out only in critical times.
Wait, are they?
It's only in the one part in the middle.
Are they a replacement for the sonic screwdriver? Did I not understand that?
That's exactly what they are. Yes, they are. They are a replacement for the sonic screwdriver.
Was Capaldi like, no, I'm not doing the screwdriver thing. Give me the sunglasses.
Again, it was a Stephen Moffat joke initially. Okay. Is the Doctor? So you had this idea of playing Peter Capaldi's Doctor as an aging rocker. So the Capaldi Doctor's got an electric guitar, and he wears sunglasses. And there was one episode where he was repeatedly wearing sunglasses indoors, and people are going, "What are you doing that for?" And the twist at the end of the story is, these aren't just sunglasses, they're sonic sunglasses. It's all about wearable technology these days, and it was a replacement for the sonic screwdriver that was used for a couple of seasons, is the Doctor's
pretend
in that.
Pretend I don't know what a sonic screwdriver is.
So you know how every other, and this is the reason why Doctor Who is the best show in the universe, how every okay. other hero carries a gun. Every other hero gets their fists out to solve a problem, and the Doctor does not. The Doctor gets his brain out, or he gets out a screwdriver to fix things. And so that it's a tool. And it's
either a riddle or it's Phillips head screws that are standing in the way.
If you never had a lot of shelves to put up, Thomas, sometimes a screwdriver that's just a little bit more sonic is exactly what you need in any given situation.
What's the sonic part? What is the sonic? Anyway, sorry, never mind. I read some stuff for this episode. I read some reviews and all that. And it really is amazing and impressive. Like, anyone who knows Doctor Who is like, well, it's like season 7, episode blah, 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 blah. When there's the thing, there's like 17 references to different episodes in the past that I've like, okay, cool, that's awesome. How do you keep that all in your head, everybody? How do you do it, Who fans? Watching it over and over and over and over? Is that the answer?
Pretty much that's what we do. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Got it. But my thing with Doctor Who is like, where do you begin? You know, because I would want to, if I was going to get really into a show, I'd want to watch like every episode. I want to start at the beginning, watch it. But that, it started in like 1780. So then you have to watch every episode until somebody explained Doctor Who to me. When did it start, and when is the actual Doctor Who that people have watched?
So Doctor Who, the show started in 1963, which makes it 3 years older than Star Trek, which I'm sure sticks in the Trekkies' craw all the time. So Doctor Who started in 1963. The first episode went out the day after Kennedy was assassinated. Which means actually it did not do so well in the viewing figures, and they had to repeat it the following week because nobody watched it, because everyone was like, wow, that massive thing just happened in the United States. And the show was in continuous production from 1963 to 1989. So it did 26 seasons in that time. across seven British different actors like, playing the Doctor.
That's like half an episode a season, right?
Well, so, and that's an interesting one as well, because those seasons got shorter as the show went on. When Doctor Who first started, 63, they were doing like 40 episodes a year, 40, 42 episodes a year.
Wow.
Whoa. It was
see, I relentless. For one agree with the British seasons of only being four or six episodes or whatever. I think that's better. I've always liked that better. So it looks like this one was 10 episodes. Is that where they found the Doctor Who sweet spot of like 10 episode seasons now?
So the 60s, they were doing like 40 episodes a year. as we moved into the 70s, they cut that down to 26 episodes a year. And these are 30-minute episodes as well, because that was the typical for the time. We weren't in the kind of 45-minute, one-hour slot. So these were half-hour episodes. But they did, they in the 70s, they went to 26 episodes. In the late 80s, they went to 14 episodes. And then when the show, which was just represented the BBC's increasing or decreasing confidence, increasing lack of confidence, I was going to say, but decreasing confidence in the show as the show aged. When the show came back, it was 13, 45-minute episodes, and it's plus a Christmas special, and it's kind of stayed around that time, around that at the moment. They're doing 10 episodes a season at the moment because they've cut them down so they can spend the same amount of money over more episodes, basically. So Doctor Who ran.
So when people say they watch Doctor Who, is it not, when did it reboot? Is it not really the 1963 to 1989? Who, or do people watch those as well?
I mean, I watch all those as well. But I got into Doctor Who
episodes.
I got into Doctor Who before I have memories. So I don't know what got me into this show. I just always remember being into this show. But when the show was cancelled in 1989, it was because Amblin, Spielberg's production company, had approached the BBC saying, we'd like to make Doctor Who, we'd like to reboot Doctor Who for the US audience. And so the BBC said, okay, let's, you know, we've got Steven Spielberg knocking on the door, let's put this to one side for a couple of years and see what comes out of it. What came out of it was a movie that Fox made in 1996, which bombed completely. It was like the Tuesday night movie on Fox, did 5 million viewers, nobody cared. And so the show disappeared for another 9 years, and it came back in 2005 and has been in continuous production since then, in 2005 until now.
And so Spielberg was like, step one, what's his gun going to look like? We need Doctor Who's got to have a better gun. He's just enough of the screwdriver nonsense.
It's funny with Steven Spielberg, because the guy, I don't think the guy likes Doctor Who. He must be sick and tired of Doctor Who, in all honesty, because in two separate occasions in his career now, with the Fox movie that they did, the executive producer on that was a guy called Philip Seagal. He also was producer on a show called Sequest DSV. You remember that, for the 90s show, Sequest, kind of sci-fi submarine show? It's weird.
Oh, yeah.
I loved that show as a kid.
Psychic Dolphins, man.
So... he worked on that show, and he was a massive Doctor Who fan. He was British. He was born in southern England, moved to the United States when he was 10 years old, became a big TV producer, became Spielberg's right-hand man, massive Doctor Who fan, and convinced Amblin to say, can we go after Doctor Who? And it was really his project. Steven was just kind of lending his name to it. And by the time it went into production, Spielberg was not involved anymore, but he's had this guy, his right-hand man on the shoulder, going, oh, Doctor Who, Doctor Who, Doctor Who. This is what it's all about. Fast forward a few years, and Spielberg was working on the Tintin movie, The Adventures of Tintin movie, and that was going to be written by Stephen Moffat, who wrote the initial draft of the first script of what was intended to be a trilogy, and then was offered to be the head writer on Doctor Who, and he said, sorry, Stephen, I'm not going to work with you anymore. I'm going to go and do Doctor Who instead. I don't know what Stephen thinks of Doctor Who, because he keeps seeing these important people in his life disappear to go and do Doctor Who instead.
That's pretty
well,
amazing.
Genuinely, thank you for that backstory, because I've never fully understood. But like, okay, so that's we'll go a little extra, because I took up critical time wondering what in the world Doctor Who is. So back to the episode. Where were we in our explanation of the episode? He's got the veiled figure chasing him. What did we get to?
So the Doctor is in what amounts to a torture chamber, a castle, and he looks up at the stars, and he can see that the stars are in the wrong position. They are in the wrong position for this time. He would know if he time traveled. He could tell if he had time traveled, because he's a Time Lord. He can feel those things. It's in his DNA. And so for the year he thinks he's in, the stars are in the wrong position, and he looks up to the sky and says they're about 7,000 years adrift of where they should be. And eventually he manages to make his way into the basement, where he discovers a wall made of what amounts to diamond. And this is the point where the Doctor has a revelation, where he realizes that he is not the first Doctor to have made their way into the basement of this castle and discover the diamond wall. And at this point, he realizes that actually he is the reason the stars are 7,000 years out of place, and he still hasn't time traveled, is actually he's already been there for 7,000 years.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, question, again, not knowing anything about this, is the ability to go regenerate another version of yourself, is that a normal Doctor thing? Like, can they do that all the time?
Well, yes
or
and
was
no.
Was that part of the castle? I didn't understand if that was like...
Both.
Like, where did that contraption come from?
In the context of this story, the Doctor was just abusing the fact that he arrived in the castle by teleport. So what he did in Star Trek terms, he went out and got his pattern out of the buffer and made a new copy of himself like Thomas Riker in Star Trek The Next Generation. That's effectively what he did.
Really? Because he like melted when he did that.
Yeah.
Didn't he have to like attach something to his brain and then...
Yep. What he did was he burned his old body to provide enough energy to generate a new body. Because conservation of energy equals MC squared, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The energy had to come somewhere to create the new Doctor out of nowhere. And so he did it by burning his old injured body to create a new copy of himself who has the same memories as he had when he arrived. And so,
yeah, and he basically just he rediscovers this mystery every single iteration.
Yes,
until
the duplicate Doctor goes through the same steps, makes the same revelations, ends up in the same basement with the same diamond wall, and has the same revelation. Oh God, I've been doing this over and over and over and over again. And the episode, when you rewatch it in the knowledge of what's going on, hints at this all the way through. Mm-hmm. The Doctor finds the skull of the previous version of himself, which he does not realize that that's what it is. And there's a nice crossfade between the two of them of kind of making it clear this is actually the Doctor's face. The Doctor finds a copy of his own clothes laid out, which is the previous Doctor's costume, which got wet and he took off. Which does mean the first
version... I've seen a lot of controversy, about a naked Doctor.
First apparently version of the Doctor who ran around this castle would have been naked, because he would have taken his clothes off and then went on from there. And so he rediscovers this mystery every time until he arrives in the basement. And what he does is he starts punching at this wall made of diamond. And of course, no one's ever going to be able to punch through a wall made of diamond. But the Doctor does it over and over and over and over again. And eventually, by the end of the episode, he's been there for 4 billion years, making a tiny dent in this wall every time until eventually he gets through and he escapes. In a sequence that reminds me of my own life, in all honesty, because sometimes I get stressed and overwork, and I listen to the soundtrack from that episode, and it's just like, Mike, just be relentless, just keep going, just keep pushing, you can do it, you can do it. And I think that's probably an unhealthy thing to model your professional life after, in all honesty.
I thought you were going to say it's like whenever you have to talk to people who don't properly respect Doctor Who, that it's like punching a wall over and over. I thought that's where
I've got more disdain for people who don't like Doctor Who than that. Thomas, it's
so awkward. I really love this bit though, with the and that he references the Brothers Grimm as he's doing this punching. There's a famous story from the Brothers Grimm called The Shepherd Boy, where the boy is asked to explain how long an eternity is, or how long a moment is in an eternity, or something like that, and he says, do you want to describe it and explain the bird and reference there?
Yeah, so you've got this story referenced by the Brothers Grimm, which is an emperor asks a shepherd's boy how many seconds in eternity, and the shepherd's boy describes a mountain of pure diamond, and it takes an hour to climb it and an hour to go around it. And every 100 years, a little bird comes and sharpens its beak on the diamond mountain. And when the entire mountain has been chiseled away, the first second of eternity will have passed. And the Doctor relates this story as the narrative unfolds, trying to explain the situation that the Doctor has found himself in. So it's a moment of exposition for the audience without it being as simple as the Doctor smacking his forehead and going, "Oh, I've been here for 2 billion years." So it's a moment of exposition for the audience of using this story of the Brothers Grimm and the Shepherd's Boy and the little bird. And the Doctor hints to the future copy of himself what is going on by writing the word bird in the dust of the room that he teleports into.
So do you think...
Is there a reason he couldn't have just written, "There's a diamond wall that you have to try"? Yeah, he only gets like one word. There's only so much chalk.
I mean, he was dying at the time, Thomas. I don't know how much attention you were paying to the episode.
Not
but...
much. I'm quarantined with two very young children, so I may never get to pay attention to this stuff, unfortunately.
So yeah, you mentioned the first Doctor, and I'm curious, given that this comes in halfway through and we're in a loop and all these things, do you have a sense of like what the first Doctor's experience would be like? Would he not figure out where the thing was, or do you figure even the first one has to figure it out to get things started, and so other than the running around naked part, everything is functionally the same?
Oh, the first one certainly has to have figured something out, because he had to have motivation to go back to the teleport to create a new copy of himself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, the whole sequence wouldn't have happened.
Technical question. Does the Doctor like a human lifespan? Like, if the first Doctor arrives there, how long would he just live without having to regenerate himself? Is he like superhuman? Does he live forever? What's the Doctor say?
So when we first met the Doctor in 1963, the intention of the production team is that he was 650 years old at that point. The first time the Doctor's age is mentioned on screen, he's 450, which was because he'd kind of de-aged 200 years when he changed his body, although that wasn't an idea that they stuck with. But the Doctor's age was reasonably consistent through the original series.
Basically, he had a lot of time to kind of poke around when he was the first iteration.
In principle, yes.
Makes sense.
Doctor at the moment, we think he's 2,000 years old. The Doctor, as he appears in this episode, is 2,000 years old.
And then afterwards, he's
now,
4 billion
years
old.
Now, when he went through this... I was just going to say, but if he recreates his body every time, what's technically speaking,
yes,
how
good.
Do you count his age? Is he 4 billion in 2,000, or is he just 2,000?
And that's an interesting question, right? Is that there's the whole teleport thing? Is it just a suicide machine? Does it kill you and make a new copy?
Because he doesn't retain memories, right?
Well, in fact, he does. And the episode doesn't make that clear enough. The subsequent episode, the Doctor makes it clear that he remembers each loop. But
I think he shouts it at one point in this episode that he does remember everything.
Yes, where he's got a line where he says, "And this is where I always remember." Mm-hmm. And that's the point where he figures it all out.
He can't remember for a while until he can.
And it's until...
I was going to say, it wouldn't really make any sense that he goes through all that
teleporter
stuff
amnesia.
Until he first encounters the diamond wall, and then suddenly it's like, oh, God, yes, this is what's happening. I remember now.
Great.
But I like it better if he doesn't.
See how good your memory is after 4 billion years in a torture chamber.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's pretty much all the stuff we need from the exposition, right? It seems like. So maybe we do a little philosophy here.
Sure.
Yeah, great. Sure. So the first thing I want to talk to about a little bit that I loved about this episode, and then I was happy to find out from Mike, was not just me projecting all my own stuff onto this episode, was the connections between the symbolism of the diamond wall and the years and such. Is that it's super weird, but it also comes up almost identically in Buddhism. There is a concept in early Buddhism and early Hinduism called a kalpa, K-A-L-P-A, which is maybe translated as an eon or something like that. But there are a bunch of different numbers for how long a kalpa is, ranging from 16 million years to 1.3 trillion years were some estimates that I found. But the Buddha gives a couple of descriptions of what a kalpa is like. And one of those descriptions is, imagine a giant rocky mountain at the beginning of a kalpa, approximately 16 by 16 by 16 miles, so dwarfing Mount Everest. You take a small piece of silk and wipe the mountain once every 100 years. According to the Buddha, the mountain would be completely depleted before the kalpa ended. So I don't know how it's possible that
I like that both of these for some reason need to stick in the 100 years. Yeah. Like, this is not quite eternal enough. We need to multiply it by 100. Why not 1,000?
Yeah.
Why not 10? Why not 1? No, I just need an extra 100x multiplier there, just for fun.
It's just crazy to imagine how, I don't know how, if there's any connection between the Brothers Grimm story and the Buddhist text. Like, I don't, it's hard to imagine that they would have had access to anything like a translation. So, you know, other than like sort of word of mouth of mythology, like there's just, it's hard to imagine there's any connection. And yet the stories seem so similar in their description that it sort of points maybe to like a universal approach by human beings to try to explain things that are so much bigger than themselves. But I initially came across this concept, Kalpa, in a old internet flash video of sorts that was like a visual narrative about someone from the religious sect called Jains, which are a famous religious sect that are incredibly respectful of life, very much like the Doctor in a lot of ways. They go out of their way to try to kill and avoid killing all sorts of animals. And
that's the American version.
That's the American version. Excuse me. That's the right. And then this story, and if anybody could ever find this story and send me a link to it and find out that it was still existing on the internet, I would reward you handsomely because it only lives in my dreams at this point. I can't find it anymore. But it's a story about a Jane who, you know, is living her life, wakes up on a bed of ants at one point when she'd gone to sleep, and like rather than get up, lays there and lets the ants like crawl all over her and bite her and stuff, and she doesn't kill any of them by standing up, and then later on gets killed by a tiger, and then way down the line in this crazy sci-fi story gets reincarnated and meets a bodhisattva, which is an enlightened being within Buddhism, and then like finds out that like because of her karma she's been reincarnated as this cool bio spaceship that's going to take the human species out into the universe. It's a trippy story, but in my mind
that took a turn.
Yeah, and always connected, and in the middle of that, right, when she's been killed before she's reincarnated, they tell the story of the Kalpa, and they do it with like a huge obsidian stone, I think was what they described it as, but same basic idea of going up and wiping it and such. And in my mind it sort of illuminated what the bodhisattva path really looks like. I think we've talked about this some before on the Buddhist virtue ethics episode, but just for a reminder, right, the bodhisattva path is where a Buddhist individual dedicates themselves to not leaving samsara, not leaving the world of suffering until every other sentient being has been liberated. And so they choose to allow themselves to be reincarnated in this kind of way. And so a kalpa to me was like the time it would take, right? Maybe many, many kalpas for you to actually be able to liberate all entities from suffering. So that was where that sort of where I had this background experience. And then I watched this and I was like, this is exactly the same kind of story. And it relates in weird ways to like questions about what it's okay to do for the sake of, I mean, in this case, revenge, but also for the sake of things like reducing suffering potentially. So, you know, with those descriptions in mind, I'm curious what y'all think, since you were mentioning the suicide machine version, you know, the view of the teleporter as a kind of suicide machine. Do you really think that it's ethical what the Doctor does over the course of this episode? There's a part in this episode that Mike didn't mention where the Doctor has a moment of doubt, right? And he basically is like, can I just stop? Can I just not torture myself over and over and again for billions and billions of years? Can I just like give up, essentially? And then he's like, no, I can't. And then he fights on and keeps doing it and stuff. But I wonder, is there something unethical about continuing to put 4 billion years worth of doctors through this suffering? What do y'all think?
It's a peculiar situation, because if it were the case that, it depends on how you consider the Doctor here. Is this multiple independent beings who happen to have the same memories? Mm-hmm. Or is this a single being? If it was definitely multiple independent beings, then I would argue that what the Doctor is doing here is unethical. Mm-hmm. However, the Doctor is in a unique position of knowing, in a way that would not happen if this were a real world situation, the Doctor is in a unique position of knowing for a fact that the next version of himself would consent to this. because he is him, and so he knows what he would think. Which I think changes the situation slightly, and makes that into something that actually, you know, I'm not sure it necessarily isn't an ethical thing. He is making this decision for many future beings hence, but each version of the Doctor subsequently goes on to have that moment of doubt and say, no, actually, I think I'm going to do this. And he knows the next version of him is going to do exactly the same thing.
That's very interesting. If you create a being in such a way that they will consent to something, is that real consent?
Yeah, I mean, I think those were all great points, right? Because I think,
like, if I design something in a lab, like I can build a sentient robot, for example, but I can also flip a switch in there that makes them want to be my slave. Am I like, well, I know for a fact that it wants to do my bidding.
But this robot is slightly different, though.
Everything's good.
This one's a little trickier.
Yeah, it is a little different,
this is a personal identity problem, right? Because the teleporter raises this question of, is this self-sacrifice or other sacrifice? And I think what Mike is pointing out is that even though they do appear to be technically different entities, there's an argument to be made that this is fundamentally equivalent to a kind of self-sacrifice, which could be considered at least morally acceptable, if not morally required. So
yes, absolutely. Yeah. And the point that Thomas was making,
though, because, oh, go ahead.
The point that Thomas was making about, you know, kind of creating a creature who would consent to that. There's a distinction to be made there between creating a creature specifically with that trait or creating a creature that just by chance has that trait. Like Douglas Adams talked about this in The Hitchhiker's Guide with the Hemigulan Major Cow, which was an animal that wanted to be eaten.
Oh, yeah.
as a kind of way to get around the unethical idea of eating meat. And it doesn't at all, because you bred the animal specifically with that intent. But the Doctor does not create the next Doctor specifically with the intent of, I'm going to create this new being to consent. He is creating this new being in the knowledge that it will consent because it is him. Mm-hmm. Which I think is a different situation.
But that almost seems like a naturalistic fallacy, maybe. Like the only consent that is real is one that's not human created. Like it has to somehow arrive by chance or whatever, which I don't know. I get the distinction, but I'm not entirely sure when you look at it closer if it really makes sense.
Well, I think in the case where you're creating a creature and designing it to have the intent that you want, it doesn't actually have any choice in that intent anymore. You have imposed that upon it, albeit by roundabout means, whereas the Doctor is imposing nothing upon his future self. He just knows enough about himself for him to know, actually, I know what I will do in that situation more completely than any being could ever know any other being, because it is literally me.
I just want to I just want to jump in here and point out.
I was going to throw in Derek Parfit, though, if you were Aaron, because like he had the teleporter, thought experiments, right? And would it change our thinking if all of a sudden, hypothetically, let's say this teleporter is able to create two beings instead of one? So like then it starts making you feel like it's not exactly the same person, that it could potentially at least be a different person.
Yeah, well, I do think that Mike's view has to buy into a certain kind of determinism about the nature of the Doctor, that the idea that like every Doctor who comes out of that teleporter will be equally determined eventually to consent to this kind of behavior, rather than like some of them maybe deciding not to. So I do think there's a concern there. And yeah, Parfit brings up teleporter problems and in terms of splits of personhood. We talked about that some before. Interestingly, he's also really fascinated by questions of like what are better worlds in a sense. And he talks about these different versions of hell. And some of those versions of hell, he divides up suffering in different kinds of ways, as all often in attempts to try to raise challenges to the kind of aggregationist utilitarian view that we've looked at before. He sort of points out that, like, you know, would it be equally bad if I just, like, to put it in terms of this episode, right? Would this be a worse
scenario if it was the same doctor the whole time rather than different doctors over and over and over again. Does that seem sort of more like a better world? Like not an ethical, not ethically speaking, but like in terms of...
No, that seems
it
worse.
It seems worse, right? For most people, it seems like it's much worse rather than spread out a bunch across a number of doctors. Now, I want to bring it, well, the thing I want to bring in here is y'all have been arguing this primarily from a deontological perspective. Whether the doctor consented is the key feature you had in mind for whether this is ethical. But I just want to point out from a consequentialist perspective, this is bananas, right? That like 4 billion years of torture. I mean, I don't know what he's going to do next because I don't know.
Well, I was just about to say what matters is the stakes here. Like, what is, I don't know enough about the show and what's happening here. Like, does he need to get, well, is that it? Or is he going to also, I don't know, save someone else or defeat a villain who would have caused other harm? Like, what are the, if we're going to try to take a consequentialist view.
Well,
like, what are the negative consequences of him just quitting and dying?
I could fill in this backstory here. So, In the previous episode,
the show stops and Mike doesn't have anything to watch anymore because he just quits. That's major.
In the previous episode, as I say, the doctor's best friend Clara was killed. In the subsequent episode, the doctor goes back in time to the moment where she was killed, plucks her from before the moment she died, causing a time paradox that the Time Lords then have to deal with because, like, oh Christ, that's not something that you're meant to be doing. You're horribly abusing your status as a Time Lord here. But in doing so, he saves Clara. And when Clara discovers what the doctor went through in order to get himself into a position where he is able to save her life, she berates him for exactly this. Why would you do something like that to yourself? Mm-hmm. And the doctor's response is, I had a duty of care to you. So the doctor's motivation here is he wants to save his best friend and he will put himself through any torture, any torment in order to save Clara's life because she means that much to him.
This is so interesting. We just did a thank you Q&A and we had a question about the acceptability of self-sacrifice. And I feel like this just highlights it beautifully. I mean, from a deontological perspective, if you're going to consent and you can, then you can consent to any amount of suffering for the sake of another person, it seems like. But there's a part of me that has a strong intuition that says, you know, you shouldn't consent to 4 billion years of suffering to save only one life. And that I'm just still ultimately skeptical that like it's truly fair to put the next doctor into that situation, knowing that they will also have doubts and unhappiness and will still make the hard choice in the end. Like, you know, it's sort of like if, you know, I had a loved one or something and I put them in a really bad situation, knowing that I could rely on them to bail me out. That seems problematic, even if I know that they will consent to it in the end.
It's interesting though, because at the point where the doctor has those doubts and he says, why do I have to keep doing this? Why can't I just lose? Why can't I just lose this time round and I don't have to keep doing this anymore? And he eventually persuades himself, and it's his image. It's the image of Clara, and that's obviously not really Clara in the episode because she's dead, but it's his memories of Clara that persuades him, no, you have to get up off your ass and win. And that's literally the line that she says to him in order to motivate him to do this. But at the point that the doctor makes that choice, he has remembered what has been happening. So at every point, when the doctor decides to continue, he is doing that in the full knowledge of the previous 7,000 years, 12,000 years, 500,000 years, however long it's actually been. It's not every doctor basing it on the suffering he has just endured over the last however many days or weeks he might have been in the castle each time round. He's doing it in the knowledge of the totality of the extent of his suffering, and even the 4 billion Earth doctor still makes that same decision to say, yes, in the knowledge of the totality of everything that I've been through, I still think this is the right thing to do for my friend.
I mean, it makes sense, but like speaking personally, just from my own cultural experience, it also sounds like Jewish guilt with more steps. So I just don't know if like I want to really buy into the idea that it's okay to say.
See, I don't like the part where he remembers all of it. Like I didn't really catch that. I thought it made more sense because, like, honestly, if I were presented with some sort of problem like this, in which the only way to save my friend was to go through this sort of, you know, almost infinite, you know, 4 billion repetitions or whatever of this thing. But on the assumption that you just go through a day or however long each thing is, and you don't remember at when it's done, like in a weird way, it's almost like you're only doing it once, you know, because like if you don't remember each time, but the fact that he remembers every time, that would be the killer part. I would never want to ever, in terms of like what self-sacrifice we're willing to do, I would never do that if I had the knowledge that I was stuck in a 4 billion year time loop or whatever it is. But if I could somehow get through it of like, well, in the end, I'll just remember that one day, really. Like, I'll wake up from the teleporter, and then I'll be that guy who punches through the last bit of diamond, you know, and I'll be like, wow, that was cool. And then I'll be fine.
And yeah. And they play with the idea of the Doctor and guilt through the show quite a lot, especially so when the show went off air in 1989, it was continued in a series of novels that ran through basically until 2005. The novels went a lot more, as you can with a novel, went an awful lot more in depth in terms of the emotion and the characterization and the psychology of the Doctor. And the Doctor in the books became a very manipulative character in an awful lot of ways, but he also was racked with guilt over the things that he's done and the things that he's seen, the people he failed to save. Over the course of the show, the original run of the show, there were three occasions in which one of the Doctor's assistants was killed. And the Doctor was not able to save them. Two of those happened in the 60s and were characters that we'd only known for a couple of weeks, but one was a long-running companion who'd been in the show.
Red shirts, you're saying? Yeah.
Basically. But one was a long-running companion who'd been in the show for a couple of seasons, and they decided that they were going to kill him off. And in the books especially, they explore the Doctor being racked with guilt at this point. And when that particular version of the Doctor dies and regenerates into the next one, his final word is Adric, which is the name of the character who died. Those are his final words as he slips away, was to say the name of the person that he lost. So we have a history in the show of the Doctor not dealing with the loss of his friends well. He always finds a way to win. He always finds a way to save them. And so when he doesn't, that's something that the character takes particularly badly.
So I want to throw in a complication here, maybe, because in trying to read up on this a little bit, it seemed on some interpretation that the having to go through this 4 billion iteration loop was more about the fact that he had a truth that he couldn't reveal versus needing to save. So like, from one thing I read, Mike, you seem to be the Mr. Doctor Who in the world, so I'm sure you'll be able to answer this. But one thing I read, it said like he could have, I still don't know why that's set up that way or why the castle is this way, but somehow confessing true things seems to do something. But anyway, they said he could have gotten through that diamond wall by confessing or telling this like secret truth that the Doctor is like guarding. But in order to avoid having to do that, that's why he went through this 4 billion iteration loop.
So it is revealed in the subsequent episode that what is happening in this episode is the Doctor, the torture chamber that he is in was manufactured by the Time Lords. It was created by the Doctor's own people in order to extract information from him. That's how it's able to fool with time. It's how it's managed to get this energetically perfect setup of a completely closed energy loop in a way that physics kind of wouldn't let you have. It's how they're able to pull ideas from the Doctor's own nightmares and use them against him, etc. And incidentally, it's why there's so many cogs and machinery around, because particularly in the new series, the 2005 onward series, they've got this quaint idea of Time Lord technology looking like the inside of a clock.
Right.
Which is why the creature collapses science. into cogs and wheels at the end. But the Time Lords are doing this in order to extract information from the Doctor about what he knows about a creature called the Hybrid. The reason the Doctor is reluctant to give up this information is he does not know who it is. Who is asking him for this information? And it may well be the case that if it were the Daleks, for example, and he were to tell them exactly what the Hybrid is, that would be enough for the Daleks to be able to wreak havoc on the universe and, you know, destroy everyone, Clara included, etc., 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 which is why this is a secret that the Doctor has decided it is worth killing himself repeatedly in order to protect.
We got to introduce Thomas to the Daleks. That's going to be a fun rant.
Yeah, I don't know what the hell that is, but that's cool.
For the better for now, because we're out of time. And I can't hear you complain about toaster killer toasters.
Any other philosophy? Any other philosophy you wanted to get to, Aaron, before we run out of time?
No, I mean, I think that was, I just wanted to hear y'all's sort of feelings back and forth about this personhood question and how it relates to these issues of self-sacrifice and suffering. Maybe we can talk a little bit more after dark about the Buddhist connections with Doctor Who in general and other such things. But I think we did pretty good here. You want to put on our sunglasses and roll out?
Yeah.
I've got one for this. Hang on a second.
Hang
on. Yeah, sunglasses. Wait, so I got the sunglasses out, right? I guess you could say bird is the word.
Wow! Yeah. Good. Maybe Brian can put in the actual song.
Yeah. Oh, God, no.
Yeah. Mike, are you familiar with CSI Miami?
Passingly so.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you get the reference to this terrible, terrible, terrible TV show. Okay. All right. Well, we are going to hop after dark, but Aaron, we got to do what we do every episode, which is give a preview for next week's show.
Yeah. So now we are definitely finally going to get to the X-Pants, right? The X-Pants. We'll just do the first episode, really, is all you need. And we're going to talk about a paper I really like called The Myth of Catching Up. It's a good paper about post-colonial philosophy.
And also, we've got to see what our patrons are making you say this week.
Yeah, thanks to our 25 tier strong AI patrons, Chad T, Dude, Jesta O, Corey Ebert, Winchester's Never Die, I Picked a Hell of a Pandemic to Quit Drinking, Alex Arnett, and Anathem, Anathem, Anathem. And all the utils, top util thanks to our $50 tier, definitely not a clone, absolutely very much pretty sure not clones, no commute, so behind on podcasts, and our new member of this tier, Sam Buck. Thank you all so very much.
All right, well, that's our show. Thanks so much for listening, and of course, patrons on patreon.com/zeroG will catch us after dark, where we'll really get into Doctor Who. The doctor gloves are coming off. We got lots more to talk about, and we will see you over there, or we'll see you next week.
That's all for the main show, but if you'd like to go to patreon.com/zeroG, you can enjoy Philosophers in Space After Dark. Here's a little sneak peek for you.
It turns out in the story that the abbot at the at this Buddhist monastery, this Buddhist retreat, is actually a Time Lord who has retired and decided to become a Buddhist on Earth instead.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.